Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
I'm Ruth Jackson, part of the Unbelievable team, and you are listening to a classic replay programme from the archives. The episode you are about to hear was first broadcast on Premier Christian Radio on the 5th of September 2009. It is the second part of a discussion about the Gospels with two Bible scholars, Christian Richard Borkham and skeptic James Crossley. To listen to part one of the debate, just search for Unbelievable wherever you get your podcasts. You can get in touch with the show and listen to more episodes at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You're
unbelievable. Today is the second in our two-part programme with James Crossley and Richard Borkham. Richard's book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, has shaken up the world of New Testament history as he makes the claim, the bold claim, that the eyewitness accounts are what's recorded in the Gospels of the earliest followers of Jesus. We'll be looking at more of those claims today in the programme. Do join me right through till 4 o'clock.
My great pleasure this week to welcome back our two guests from last week, Richard Borkham and James Crossley. And we've got a second bite of the cherry, as it were, as we continue to talk about Jesus and the eyewitnesses. If you weren't listening last week, I do encourage you to go to the podcast, premier.org.uk/unbelievable, and download the first edition of this. It'll really give you the introduction to what we're going to be talking about today. Richard's book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, has shaken up the world of biblical criticism as he makes a very strong case for the Gospels being eyewitness testimony. And he even goes so far as to make claims of who those eyewitnesses were. In fact, makes the quite audacious claim in many ways that the Gospel of John, the last book many would consider to be able to nail down as an eyewitness account, as being actually written by an eyewitness, namely John. So a really interesting discussion we were having last week, gentlemen. We sort of got from you your basic thesis, Richard. James, you were concerned on some levels. You agreed with much, but were concerned at particularly Richard's claim that John is an eyewitness account. Mm. You feel that John is just very theologized. It's obviously worked out a lot of theology. It feels to you too late to have been written by an eyewitness. Is that the sense?
Wouldn't
I'm
say too
from?
Late. It seems to me that there's some creative writing up, rewriting, inventing going on with John's gospel now. Whether that's by a community or whether that's by an eyewitness, the same issue arises. You know, I mean, how reliable is an eyewitness testimony ultimately?
Yeah, and that's perhaps what we need to discuss today, is the whole concept of eyewitness testimony, which is perhaps what we could look into in today's programme. Because, I don't know, when I hear someone talking about eyewitness testimony, I think of a courtroom and someone up on the stand and being asked by a barrister to describe what happened as an eyewitness. And then you'll get another eyewitness come along and they might have a slightly different version of events, and so the jury will be left to decide who was the most trustworthy. Perhaps one of them was under the influence of alcohol when they were describing it or whatever. I mean, and in many ways the book does act as a bit of a detective novel. That's part of the fun of it, I think, Richard, that as you read it, you're sort of trying to get behind, well, why would this eyewitness have said this? And whereas the other eyewitness said this, well, maybe this is the reason, you know, and we heard a bit of that last week as well. We were talking about the maybe one eyewitness wanted to grant some anonymity to certain people because of the time at which that story was being written down, and they might get into trouble by someone a later time. And this is your reason for thinking that I know certain characters in the Gospel of John that are given names who aren't given names in the earlier Gospels. You say that's because John was able to kind of let that cat out of the bag at that point. So really interesting stuff, you know. But why should we, I suppose, ultimately trust the eyewitnesses themselves? I mean, could they have been making it up? Could they have got their stories together, you know, and sort of come up with this story about Jesus and his death and resurrection and that sort of thing? I mean, that might be where a lot of people's minds will naturally go.
Yeah. I mean, I think probably the first important thing to say is that people have asked, well, does it really make any difference if this comes from the eyewitnesses? They could get it wrong too, so does it help? I mean, the thing to say about the eyewitnesses is simply that they were in a position to know. I mean, that's the really important thing about the eyewitnesses. They were in a position to know. And, you know, if you think about how you trust people who witness to things, why do you trust people's testimony? You have to be sure they're in a position to know. You have to have a good idea that they're in a position to know. If they're not in a position to know, you know, that's a real ground for doubt. So at least they were in a position to know. Of course, that doesn't mean that they got everything right, and absolutely no historical argument could ever prove finally that everything that someone says is correct. I did do a lot of work on the psychology of eyewitness memory, and there's a whole lot of scientific studies out there which actually nobody has drawn on before in relation to Gospels that I think is really very interesting stuff. I found it fascinating. And there is a lot of study that sort of points to the kinds of things that would be remembered well and how it is that people do remember well when they do. And the kinds of things that are remembered well are unusual events. You don't usually remember your regular day-to-day routine. You remember unusual things. Things that really were important to you, things that were really significant, you remember. Things that emotionally affected you. And some people find that a bit difficult. It seems to be bringing in an element of subjectivity. But I think there is an important element of subjectivity that actually the things that really affect you are the things that have gone deep enough into you to stay there, you know. So those are the kinds of things that are remembered well. Conversely, things that aren't remembered well are dates. Very, very rarely, unless it's kind of integral to the story, it's something that happened on your birthday, you remember the date. Otherwise, you don't remember dates of things. And you remember the gist rather than the details. And I think everybody retelling stories that are important to them, the details will vary over time and to different audiences and so on, but the gist remains constant.
What do you make of, and this is slightly off at a tangent, so forgive mm-hmm. me, but those who do want to harmonise the Gospels
yes.
and say, well, you've got this account of the resurrection, you've got this account of the resurrection, and there seem yes. to be differences in the details,
yes.
but you could see that if so-and-so went off here and then so-and-so came, that would make sense of why they saw something different to so-and-so. And some people obviously feel that's important, that if you're going to believe in the Gospels, they have to all be telling exactly the same story. Mm. Others say, well, look, these are just different people's accounts.
Yes.
But does that mean that if there is something if there is an obvious contradiction, that therefore someone's got it wrong? Does that mean that the Bible is wrong? Is there then a theological implication about that? I mean, where do you kind of land up on this sort of area?
Well, I think there are two things going on. There are certainly different memories. I mean, I think actually there's no real problem about regarding the four accounts of the visit to the empty tomb by the women, in which is a story we have all three Gospels, of course. I see no reason why these should not go back to different eyewitnesses telling the story slightly differently. I mean, these are, if it happened, it was an extraordinary thing to happen. You know, these women were overwhelmed by it. It's not surprising if they tell it slightly differently. There's also a question of storytelling. And, you know, one thing that happens is that John tells the story and he only has Mary Magdalene. He kind of individualizes it. And that's good storytelling. I mean, if you focus on an individual, it makes much more impact. You're much more affected by a story that's about an individual. You know, this is kind of close relation of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. It makes it a better story. And anyone telling anyone recounting history in the ancient world had to tell good stories. It's communication. It's not just sort of dry writing down of detail. You know, it's communication. And so there's a sense in which varying the detail or the way you tell it is part of good storytelling. And I think ancient people got happy with the idea that stories were told somewhat differently by different storytellers.
But does that mean then stuff was made up?
No, it doesn't. What John has done is to focus on the one woman and left the others out of the picture. Though he does betray the fact that the other women there. As Mary Magdalene comes back to the apostles and she says, "We found the tomb empty," or whatever. Mm. So there's just one point that suggests Mary Magdalene actually had companions. Mm. But John has focused the story on Mary,
which is the rule of good storytelling. You focus on a character rather than
And John, I think, is a brilliant storyteller. You know, it's part of the taking longer to tell each story that John does. You know, the story of Lazarus and Martha and Mary goes on a bit, but you get this real sense of characters and people you're involved with. So John is a skillful storyteller. But that doesn't mean he's untrue to the facts necessarily, an ancient historian had to do both.
I know, James, that when we've had these sorts of discussions in the past, you've been open to the idea that there was a penchant for adding and for, if you like, dramatising at the very least, and possibly adding extra things to stories. And I remember there was a bit of a to and fro between you and Michael on the whole thing in the resurrection account, Jesus' crucifixion of the dead coming out, and you saying, well, isn't that an example of addition to a historical account? So, I mean, where do you stand on eyewitness testimony? Do you think that eyewitnesses were essentially telling just what they had seen, or were they prone to adding to kind of remembering, but remembering more than maybe had really happened?
Well, I quite liked Richard's idea of the gist more than is. I think that's the important thing about it. You know, we know it's sort of roughly right, so we don't have to be too worried about slight discrepancies as if this is evidence that it didn't happen and so on and so forth. What I would like to do to Richard's model is inject a little chaos, if you like.
You're always wanting to inject chaos.
I don't know if you can inject chaos, but and see, you know, more elaborate storytelling, if you like, taking place. You know, invention perhaps, and this is where we've debated before on the issue of the miraculous. Whereas I think one of the implications of Richard's model is that there are eyewitnesses to miracles. I mean, it has to be in one sense. I mean, and you do here and there, you know, give reference to the incidental details of miracle stories. And that seems to mean, if you accept that, that is a revolutionary move in terms of, you know, the humanities, if you like, or history and so on. I mean, that's where I would like to just see.
So what are you saying? Are you saying then that up to this point you can only be taken seriously as a historian if you have a detached view whereby you say, we all know the miracle didn't take place, but they believed something had taken place? Whereas you're saying Richard is saying, this is an eyewitness account of a miracle, and therefore it has to be taken as having happened.
I would always qualify by saying I would never judge who gets taken seriously or not. What I would say is it's more about this is a revolutionary move. If you follow the implications through of Richard's model, is you've got eyewitnesses to miracles, and that's a serious issue.
Give us an example of a miracle that is testified to, which you would clearly see as counting as evidence for eyewitness testimony, Richard. I mean,
oh, I'm sorry. Yes. I mean, the thing I did in the book, and I think it was probably a mistake that I didn't explain I was doing this, but I did treat the miracles in the gospel accounts just on a level with everything else. I didn't make any special issue of them, and that's the way I do it myself. But I quite see that. That for many people that's an issue, and I should at least do it. The reason I didn't go into it, of course, is it becomes, I think, a philosophical issue whether miracles are possible and so on. I mean, it is, of course, a question of what worldview one comes to the evidence with. And I can quite see that if someone has a worldview which excludes the possibility of miracle, then they're already disinclined to be convinced by the evidence, which might well convince them of something much more ordinary. There is a question, of course, what counts as a miracle, and I would suspect that James Would you be quite happy with many of Jesus' healings?
Yes, I've said yes, and exorcisms.
Yes.
I wouldn't define them in terms of miraculous necessarily.
No, I mean, most...
But you would see that people who witnessed that would have witnessed something which you might see now as being some sort of psychoanalytical thing, but they would have said a miracle.
Well, they might not necessarily. They wouldn't necessarily call it a miracle. I don't know. I mean, that could depend from case to case. But I think we could agree that we could potentially have eyewitness testimony to things like this.
Okay.
Yes, I think the way they thought of miracle, I mean, they didn't think of miracle as an exception to natural law in the way that we would. I mean, they thought of miracle as a sort of very unusual and therefore arresting and impressive event, you know, which drew your attention to God being at work in some way or other. And so I don't think that we need necessarily impose our distinction between what is and what isn't in accord with the laws of nature. And of course, one of the things about science is that, you know, there are things that people used to think couldn't happen according to scientific understanding, which we can now say how they happened. You know, I mean, science does sometimes end up explaining things that used to be inexplicable. I think there are a number of things going on here. I mean, one of the things is, it seems to me, that any historian approaches the evidence and the work of a historian with certain assumptions about what the world is like. I mean, for example, there are some historians who are convinced of a sort of economic determinism in history, that really everything that happens can be traced back to economic factors. You know, there's a sort of great man theory of history, you know, in which it's these great individuals who really turn the course of history. I mean, these are presuppositions with which people come to the evidence, and they strongly affect the way people read the evidence. And I think being open to the possibility of exceptional events is a difference of that kind. It doesn't seem to me it has to be a kind of completely different form of approach. So I would say that all historians have views of the world that affect the way they read the evidence. And of course those views of the world can then be affected by the evidence. And there's probably a sort of interactive thing going on there.
Is part of the problem, James, that you would never think about countenancing the miraculous in other areas of history, which might mention miraculous events, you know. So there may be, in pagan, you know, histories, talk of events, but you wouldn't expect people looking into the history of that to think that that actually happened just because someone says it happened. And therefore, why should we treat the Gospels differently in that sense, as though they have a special status where we can do history and talk about these things as having miraculously occurred? Is that part of your...
Well, I think so. I mean, if you take Richard's view, then you have to judge everything by that standard. So that's pagan, Jewish, whatever. Those need to be open. I've not actually given an opinion whether I said that miracles should or shouldn't be included in history. I think what I think is it's not just a revolutionary idea in terms of eyewitness testimony and views of form criticism. It's a revolutionary method in terms of this would, if Richard's correct, be direct, you know, very clear evidence of miraculous or something like the miraculous taking place. And that needs to be pursued. I mean, I know there is the difficult philosophical issue, but we all practice history. And if we're going to include something as dramatic as that, then I think it needs to be fleshed out a little.
Is the consequence of that, James, that weighs against, as it were, against Richard's thesis that this is eyewitness testimony? I mean, if you have stories of the miraculous, is for you, does that mean they can't have been written down by eyewitnesses because the eyewitness wouldn't have come away thinking it was a miracle, but it's someone who heard about the story in a slightly different format, then attributes it to being miraculous or something? I mean, are you saying that you, if you have an eyewitness and they describe something miraculous, they just have to be wrong or mistaken?
No, not so. We do have people who say such things. But it would mean that Richard's model would be is questioned a little then in terms of, you know, not necessarily wrong or anything, just questioned in terms of reliability of eyewitnesses. Did they really see miracles? What did they see? That kind of thing. I mean, those ideas, I think, need to be fleshed out as well with Richard's model because, you know, these are significant
philosophical
issues.
I suppose one that people often come up with is, you know, the feeding of the 5,000, etc. You know, was it really a miracle? Did it actually, you know, people had brought some along with them and they shared it amongst each other and everything. And I mean... But the eyewitnesses, you know, the disciples or whoever passed it on to the people who wrote down the Gospels said a miracle took place because we only had these many loaves and fishes and by the time we were finished we were gathering up baskets of the stuff. I mean, is that where you see maybe the problem being, James, that an eyewitness may think they saw something, but in fact there might have been another explanation?
Well, I mean, no. Yes and no in one sense. This is what I'd say, you know, what is the gist of that story then? What is the kind of, what is it getting at, you know, that was happening in the life and teaching of Jesus? I mean, what my own explanation would probably be, I guess, if I was to write something on this in detail, that it's a piece of creative Jewish storytelling of the sort we find in other texts, without, you know, that seems to me a perfectly reasonable way of explaining why we get stories such as the miracle stories. Now, I might be wrong, of course, and happy to be proven wrong, but it's really questioning Richard's theory. Could you have the creative storytelling as well as the eyewitness testimony? Or if not, what is the gist of something like a feeding miracle?
Yes, I mean, I don't think some kind of creative storytelling can be completely ruled out. But, I mean, one of the things I think about this is that it's a question of trusting your witnesses. And it seems to me that basic to historical method is that we consider whether a witness is trustworthy. And having decided that there's good reason to think the witness trustworthy, we then have to actually trust the witness, you know. So sometimes this may mean saying that, you know, something really rather unlikely, we've got to take their word for it because they're right about everything else, so we trust them in general. You know, I mean, this is part of my whole issue of methodology in the book, is that what I don't think we can do is take the gospel events, you know, one story by one story, one at a time, one saying of Jesus, and sort of weigh up the probability of each one of them one by one. I mean, the form critical thing required you to do that because that's how they thought they came to the evangelists. Just, you know, they'd all come through community oral transmission. And that's how the Jesus Seminar does it. You know, they vote on each event and give it a rating, as it were. I think normal historical method is that you go for the general reliability of your sources. And so we've just got to think about whether Mark is generally a trustworthy witness. There may be special reasons for doubting, you know, this or that within Mark, but on the whole, I think we've got to kind of go for trustworthy sources, and having decided they're trustworthy, go along with them, give them the benefit of the doubt in difficult cases. I mean, I think that all kinds of very odd things happen in the world. And there are events in modern history for which it's very good a testimony, but I have no idea what was really happening. You know, Fatima in Spain, you know, where hundreds of people saw an appearance of the Virgin Mary, and incredible testimonies to it. And I'm not inclined to think that the Virgin Mary appeared to all these people, but something happened, and I'm not going to, you know, I have no way of explaining it away. So it seems to be a historian can very often, if they feel inclined, say something odd happened. We don't know what it was, but something odd happened. What the historian is not obliged to do is to explain everything. Why should we think we know how this or that happened all the time? You know, we're just dealing with the evidence, and the evidence may just point to something extraordinary that we don't know what to do with. And in the case of the Gospels, I mean, I think this is the case with regard to the resurrection, you know, which is the important miracle. Mm. You know, if we believe that Jesus healed and exorcised, as virtually everyone does, but didn't still the storm or feed the 5,000. I mean, that doesn't make a huge difference to our reading of the story of the Gospels. The resurrection does. The resurrection is the extraordinary thing. And, of course, Christians have never wanted to say the resurrection is just another miracle. It's quite an exceptional miracle. It's something extraordinary happening to Jesus, comparable only with the resurrection of everybody else at the end of history, which hasn't happened yet, you know. So I think the resurrection is in a remarkable category. It's an exceptional event on any terms, both because of what Christians said about it and also because of the role that it plays in the actual beginning of the Christian movement. The resurrection is exceptional. And if, and it, to accept what the early Christians said it meant, of course, you've got to buy into the early Christian worldview. I take that. And if you come with different worldviews, your attitude to the evidence is going to be different. I think if I were not a Christian, I'd have to say something extraordinary happened and I don't know what it was. It doesn't seem to me that it's susceptible to other explanations. So I think all I'm saying is that all historians, faced with these kinds of witness to things that can't be easily explained, need a bit of humility.
It's an interesting facet of the resurrection accounts that when it comes to eyewitness, women are the primary eyewitnesses in every account. I mean, that a lot has been made of that, you know, as being, you know, in an ironic way, a great supporter of the case for the resurrection, in as much as at the time they'd been wanting to make a case for something that was not true. They wouldn't have chosen to make women their primary, if you like, defendants of it. I mean, how much does the issue of women's testimony come into Jesus and the eyewitnesses? Do you put that in a special category in terms of where, if they were setting down things that women were saying, would they have had in their mind at the time, oh, people aren't going to believe this if I say that Mary said it, or that sort of thing?
I mean, actually, the pagan critic of Christianity, Celsus, in the second century, I mean, we only have excerpts of what he said in Origen's reply to him, but he's the first pagan critic that we have of Christianity, and he says at one point, you know, you're asking us to believe what a hysterical woman said. And there was, I think, this general suspicion of women, especially in religious matters, that they were gullible. So I think I'm less inclined to make a lot of the idea of whether women's witness counted in court in a Jewish context. I mean, some people make a lot of that. I'm not sure that is as relevant as the general sense that women were gullible and unreliable in religious matters. And also that women ought not to be the recipients of revelation. You know, the whole idea of, you know, the role of men in the Jewish tradition, you know, that women are not the recipients of revelation, which is why, you know, in Luke, the women come to the apostles and the apostles don't believe them. They think it's nonsense, you know. The two disciples on the way to Emmaus, it's just an idle tale that these women told, you know, they just dismiss it. So the Gospels are quite explicit about, you know, this is not good evidence. So I think that is an odd fact of the evidence, that such an important role is given to the women.
What do you make, then, of all this, James? Because does this ultimately pose a serious problem for Richard's theory? Because ultimately his key eyewitnesses are all basically pointing to one, you know, event, which, on your understanding, can't have happened in the way that they relate it happening. There must have been another explanation, or it was, you know, could be seen in some other light, presumably. Where do you go with that?
Well, I wouldn't put it in such stark terms. I have a kind of methodological indifference about certain things, and when it comes to the reality behind the resurrection, say, then, you know, I'm really not fussed at all, in one sense. I mean, I think Richard said it, I've said it on this programme. We know something happened. We know that there were witnesses to something or other happening. And I mean, this is where I disagreed with Michael Bird last time. He seemed to me to be insistent on trying to prove it really happened. When I said, well, why don't we just agree that something dramatic happened and it was important for Christian origins and what happened next and so on and so forth. And there were certainly witnesses, eyewitnesses, people had these visions. We can all agree on that, and we can move on. I mean, we can take their testimony at first hand as well. You know, we think, you know, Jesus was raised and so on. Great. That can help us in historical explanation. I don't think there's much
but
of a tension.
Does it mean that we haven't got reliable eyewitnesses, though? I mean, is that what it means if people are claiming that this is stuff happened?
No, not necessarily. I mean, it depends. I would want to discuss the resurrection stories again in terms of something like storytelling or something like that, it could be viewed in those terms potentially. In terms of just the resurrection appearances. I think it's a stronger piece of evidence for eyewitness testimony we've probably got in the New Testament. And we have to say it's reliable. They saw something, they believed this to be the case. I think I don't see a problem.
We'll come back to this in a moment as we take a short break here. We're talking about Jesus and the eyewitnesses as we look again now and at the book that Richard Borkham wrote and won the Ramsey Prize this year. And as we ask, what about the testimony that Richard believes is present in the Gospels? Can we trust those people who were the first witnesses? Were they witnessing? Would we see it in the same way today? Was there a difference in what counted for eyewitness testimony in the ancient world? All these questions and more as we continue to discuss these important aspects of the New Testament and its history.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
The earliest witnesses to Jesus were, of course, the disciples, those who knew him, the people who saw what they claimed to be miracles. We're asking in that whole area of the accounts of Jesus in the Gospels, what about those first eyewitnesses? Richard Borkham, in his book Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, says that there is good evidence that the Gospels are based on first-hand eyewitness testimony. In fact, even written by an eyewitness in the case of John. But we're asking, what about those who did claim to see the miraculous, who travelled with Jesus? What did their testimony count for? What was happening in the ancient world when people recorded their testimony? I'm wondering sort of how much after the actual events, Richard, would a lot of this stuff have been put down, if you like? Because if you asked me now to write an account, I was trying to do it the other day, actually, with my wife. We were trying to think back to the birth of our first child. And we thought, we're going to kind of not remember all the details if we don't write it down now, because they kind of just fade a bit more. And so we were desperately trying to think about, and then that happened, didn't it? And then that happened. But the fact is, if you asked me in 10 years, I'd probably have less idea. So in that sense, the detail does tend to fade over time, presumably. What would have, but yet we do seem to have a lot of detail in some of these Gospels, down to quite individual things. Now, was there some way in which that was being kept fresh in the minds of the eyewitness? Was it because they were recounting it on a regular basis?
Yes, I think the basic point is that the eyewitnesses would be constantly telling these stories. And, the psychological data I was talking about earlier, one of the things that makes for good memory is to be repeating. If you're suddenly asked to think of something that happened 20 years ago and you've never thought about it in the interim, you'd have trouble. But frequent repetition aids memory. There is, of course, a difference with the ancient world in that nobody did what you just suggested. I mean, nobody actually would write down for their own use something they wanted to remember. They would simply rely on their memory. And it's not that people had better memories, but they were trained to use their memories because they had to rely on them in a way that we don't. So there was a sort of cultural element there as well. I think some of the psychological stuff is actually very disturbing if you think about court cases, because what's happening in court cases is actually very different. Very often what you're requiring of a witness in a court is for them to tell you about something they weren't particularly interested in when it happened, some detail, something they weren't really observing.
No.
There's no reason to remember it or even really to take much notice of it. What colour was that car? They weren't interested. And that's why an event that's really involving is much better remembered than some incidental thing that you weren't interested in.
Is there a case for saying that the more detail there is in a story, the more we can assume that the storyteller is an eyewitness of that particular story? So if they, in the Gospel of Mark, it happens to mention that Jesus lay down on a pillow in the back of the boat, it's a kind of an extra detail. Does that show, therefore, that
I think one has to be very careful about this. I think there's a sort of vividness that a good storyteller can conjure up by means of details. I think the most interesting cases are where a detail doesn't really seem to contribute to the story. And one might sometimes, I think that the healing of the blind man, where Jesus, if you remember the story, he heals the man. And the man says, "I see people walking like trees." And then Jesus does something else and he gets his sight back. You know, this is obviously a sort of stage of getting the sight back where, you know, I see people walk. That seems a very odd thing. It doesn't fit the usual genre of a miracle story. It's none of the sort of standard elements in a miracle story. I think that's just somebody remembered that and it was such an odd thing to say, it really stuck in their memory. Mm. You know, so I think there are cases where it looks very likely that some detail is something that's sort of stuck in the memory.
But you're always willing, Richard, to give people the benefit of the doubt in that sense, to mm-hmm. have the best reading for mm-hmm. the idea that it's an eyewitness mm-hmm. account. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could imagine, James, that you would go down the line more of there was a sense in which stories became embellished and, or, you know, were added onto and things arose as stories circulated around, which is kind of in contradiction to what Richard is saying. I mean, is that where you feel a lot of these claims of the miraculous have come from in the Gospels? Is creative, as you've called it, creative storytelling, where people have sort of wanted to add a bit to something to make it that little bit more special?
Well, I mean, I think in many cases that would be a perfectly plausible explanation. If I were ever to write on this, is probably, I would imagine, the kind of conclusion I'd come to, and so on. The interesting thing was, though, is Richard liked the general reliability and against the case-by-case basis to some degree. Where the interesting thing is, when working on case-by-case basis, I felt there was quite a lot of material that I thought, you know, theoretically would go back to historical Jesus, and then I found Richard's model useful. So as a kind of support for that, so I wouldn't want to actually rule it out so much yet. The other question I want to ask Richard, I can't remember if you touch on this in your book or not, and it's one that's been brought up here, is written testimony. And I mean, if you use the analogy of courts, things get written down, of course, and I'm a bit worried about oral tradition a lot of the time myself. It sounds very romantic and things. I mean, would you have any objection to the idea of material being written down very early as well to preserve it, not just telling each other all the time, which I'm sure is true, but Dead Sea Scrolls, right? Everyone writes things.
Yes, I think it's perfectly possible. I do have a little bit of discussion of that in the book, and I think it's perfectly possible. I don't really see much way of getting beyond saying it's perfectly possible. It's very difficult. I mean, I think in this discussion of how things were transmitted, there's a danger of getting away from my basic point, which is I think the evangelists had it in many cases from the eyewitnesses, or, you know, certainly not far from. So, I mean, I think one is dealing with a different situation if you're talking about something as the Forbin critics did, which passed down, you know, through many, many transmissions before it gets to the evangelists, and the situation with the close contact with the eyewitnesses. I think that does make a difference. None of this is foolproof. People improve their own stories. You know, this does happen. I'm not in any case arguing for precise detail in every case, but in terms of general reliability, it seems to me it makes a difference if you're close to the eyewitnesses.
And you think people in any case were more reliable in their memory than they are now, in fact, when we rely on all sorts of other things to retain our thoughts and memories. Back then, when people were really relying on their own memory.
And you see, when Paul talks about oral transmission, I mean, Paul says to the Corinthians, in Corinthians again, you know, he's talking about how, and he has the tradition of the institution of the Last Supper. You know, it's one rare case where Paul actually tells a little story from the gospel tradition. And he said, he says, "I transmitted to you as I received it from the apostles," is the assumption. Now, that's the language of formal transmission of traditions, which happened, of course, among the Pharisees, standard part of Jewish culture, that traditions were handed over. And it means a formal process of learning and transmitting. It doesn't mean you just hear the story and then you try and remember it a week later. It means you make an effort to fix it in your mind, you know, you learn it. And the other thing about much of the stuff in the Gospels when it comes to Jesus' sayings is that the sayings are formulated in memorable form. And I think that's quite deliberate. Jesus' teaching as we have it is sayings that were formulated to be remembered.
Now, are you saying in that that Jesus, when he first pronounced them, said them in a way that was memorable?
Yes.
So that his disciples would remember them? Or are you just saying they reformulated what he had said in a memorable way to pass on?
No, I think they are carefully crafted sayings. Jesus was a Jewish teacher, and this was done in the Jewish tradition. You carefully crafted your sayings. So, you know, all these little aphorisms in the Gospels, you know, the one who loses his life will save it, and the one who saves his life will lose it. You know, it's formulated in this neat epigrammatic style that you remember.
What about bits of dialogue, though? Obviously with sayings which he might have repeated again and again in to crowds in his preaching. I mean, but conversations just one-on-one with a disciple in one situation. I mean, is it likely, you know, that those have been transmitted in, you know, if you'd stood there with a dictaphone, you would have had the same as John later came up with, you know?
I think it depends whether they're just part of the story. I mean, when Jesus, in the feeding of the 5,000, to go back to that, you know, asked the disciples, what have we got? And they say, you know, I mean, that's just a bit of how you tell the story. Yeah. Whether Jesus said those words or different words, you know, has no importance, really. So I think there are bits of dialogue that is simply part of the story and which are, you know, detail rather than gist.
Yeah, I suppose it's because when it does come to the theological use of this stuff, you know, many a minister or something will maybe plant a whole sermon on a particular sentence Jesus said in some way. And he may not have said it quite that way. It was the way that the evangelist put it down. Does it make a difference in that sense?
It depends what you hang on it. I mean, another thing that preachers do is to retell a gospel story, you know, adding bits here and there to bring it to life for the congregation. That's a quite reasonable thing to do, you know, to make us, in a way, it's what people in the ancient world did. They told it so as to bring it to life. It's storytelling as well as fact. I mean, the two go hand in hand.
I mean, coming back to you, James, as another guest I had in this show put it, you may think, you know, of the stories being embellished in a rather Chinese whispers style way. The only thing is, what's fun about Chinese whispers is you have the original person who said the phrase in the room so that you can laugh at how it's changed because you can check back with the original person. Now, isn't what Richard's saying that there wouldn't have been this changing and embellishing because you have the original eyewitness to check it up against who can say, no, that actually happened this way, so that, I mean, isn't that the whole point of the book, really, that this creative storytelling was, there was a cap on it, if you like, because there were eyewitnesses around to say, actually, it happened this way?
Yes and no. I mean, it depends on your notion of truth here in some ways. If, you know, had our concept of truth, we might think in those terms. But there is the possibility that people had no problem with creative storytelling. It wasn't necessarily a bad thing to do things like this. And, I mean, there's the work of one of my favourites, Roger Ouse, who was, I mean, he reads a lot of the Haggadic Jewish storytelling material and sees what he can find in the Gospels particularly about this. And he, you know, talks about it in terms of religious truth all the time, and he doesn't have a problem with it. He says, and gives various examples where Jewish figures had no problem with the idea of, you know, creative rewriting. So, I mean, I could see theoretically there being no problem with this among Christian groups. Maybe some did, maybe some wanted to check, maybe some were perfectly comfortable with the idea of, you know, writing up these stories in different ways. So that's what I mean by chaos in a way, in some ways. I think you can have, I don't think it's an either or, I think it's potentially both and.
Do you see the same thing, Richard, there?
I think some of this comes down to an issue of genre, literary genre, and I buy into the view that the Gospels would have been seen by their first readers and hearers as biographies in the ancient sense of the bios, the life of a great person. And I think with the contemporary biography, that is, the biography written within living memory of the person, there would have been an expectation of eyewitness testimony to substantial truth. And I think that's probably where I would distinguish the Gospels from, for example, the retellings of Old Testament stories, of which we have a huge amount in Jewish literature, you know, where the stories are treated quite freely and details added, and, you know, sometimes they just get their imagination working on the Old Testament stories. I think the question of literary genre Because that's the importance of genre. You know how to read something because you identify it as this sort of literature. You know, you don't read a historical novel as history because you know it's a historical novel. You identify the genre correctly. You know, when T.S. Eliot puts a poem into the mouths of the Magi, you know, the wise men, you don't think he's seriously giving us, you know, a bit of history. You know it's a poem. So identifying genre is absolutely crucial. And I do think the argument... Richard Bowdry's argument has been very widely accepted, actually, that the Gospels are in that category of biographical literature is important.
But they are also theological,
yes,
aren't they?
Yes.
And so would there have been a capacity, and I'm guessing this is where you're saying, James, that for them to invent things for the sake of the theological argument they're progressing, so to, I don't know, in perhaps the triumphal entry into Jerusalem, they want to make it very clear that this is fulfilling a prophecies in the Old Testament, and so maybe Jesus wasn't actually riding on a donkey. That's what they've given him in this instance, because they really want to drive the point home, and they weren't as subject to the rigours of what counts as historical truth as we are today. I mean, that might be where... You know, someone might say that's the way they were in the ancient world. They weren't as concerned with making sure every detail was perfectly true.
Well, I don't think they were as concerned with getting every detail exactly true. And that's my point about storytelling. You know, you have license to vary the detail, but retain the gist. But that's what I think ancient readers expected in terms of faithfulness to the history. They expected a story that tells the gist of what happens. Even if the details may be varied, in order to tell a story. But you see, I think John is very interesting on this, because when John tells the story of the triumphal entry, he says the disciples didn't know what was happening. They realised afterwards. And that's what the studies of psychological data on eyewitness memory call deferred meaning. That sometimes, in retrospect, you see what something meant, which you didn't at the time. But John, I think, is making, therefore, a careful distinction between what actually happened and the significance that was later seen in it. And I think you can see that also in John's Gospel, where he tells the same stories as the synoptics, but he finds much more symbolic meaning in them. And if that's the model for what he's doing with stories that we don't have in the synoptics, I think it implies that John doesn't invent events. He tells the events. He sees new meaning in them. You know, he's very into the symbolic value of the events, but he doesn't invent the events for the sake of the symbolic value. He knows the events first, and then he gets his theological ingenuity to work on the symbolism that's going on.
If you're listening and you want to find out more, don't forget Richard's book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, is available to buy. I've put a link to it on the Unbelievable webpage, premier.org.uk/unbelievable. You can download this programme there as a podcast, and indeed many others of a similar nature that you may be interested in. Do check through the archives there. You can also get in touch if you'd like to get in touch with anything you hear in the programme today. Do email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. The phone line also available if you wish to leave a voicemail message, 08456 52 52 52. And select option 5.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, fascinating stuff. Before we go any further, just tell us, you kind of make a comparison in your book between more recent testimony of the Holocaust, eyewitness testimony to the Holocaust. What's the comparison you're making with that?
I think it's a very interesting comparison. I mean, one thing about it, of course, is we have loads of testimonies of survivors of the Holocaust, and because we're just about at the point where the very few of them left, I mean, there has actually been a really serious effort, you know, quite recently to record all these testimonies. I think it's rather like the Gospels being written at the point where the eyewitnesses are getting to be rather thin on the ground. So you get it down in writing, it's important. But the more substantial comparison I make is between exceptional events where if we didn't have, in the case of the Holocaust, if we didn't have the testimony of people who were actually there in the death camps, we wouldn't really know what the experience was like or what went on, you know. We would know a lot of external facts, you know, they built these, you know, and all that sort of stuff, but we depend on the people who experienced it to know what was really going on, you know, significance and how it felt like and all that sort of stuff. And this, I think, verifies the idea that testimony from involved participants in exceptional events is actually not a liability but an advantage, and it's actually what you need in the case of exceptional events. You know, if we didn't have the testimony, the things that went on in the Holocaust, none of us would be inclined to believe. I mean, we wouldn't be inclined to believe that people could actually perpetrate such extraordinary evil and work in those ways, unless we had the testimonies to tell us. So the testimony of those who were at the receiving end is actually indispensable for understanding the Holocaust. So I think this preference of ancient historians for involved participants is a very important historical principle, which a certain attitude to history in the modern period, which says what we actually need is the observation of disengaged, dispassionate observers. Well, disengaged, dispassionate observers don't actually get to the heart of what's going on. It's the involved participants who do.
And in that sense, a lot of people have... I've almost felt that sometimes the only things that some historians are going to take as verifiable in the New Testament documents, in the Gospels especially, are things that are verified by outside sources, by Josephus and Tacitus, and, you know...
Yes, and there's a terrible danger in history of reducing history to the scope of a modern historian's experience. You know, we're testing everything by what we find credible and what's part of our own experience. I mean, we all have incredibly limited experience, and historians who spend most of their lives in their studies have less experience than most people. So, you know, this criterion of the historian's own knowledge of the world is actually a very limiting one. I don't think we should be constrained by that.
I mean, do you see this... That as well, James, that as much as obviously I'm sure you do see the Gospels as being partisan in terms of the people who wrote them believed the things had happened, I mean, you can't get away from that, can you, in terms of actually getting to the heart of a story? It's going to be told by the people who were most involved with it, I suppose.
Oh, sure. I mean, I agree with all that, really. I mean, I'm not sure too much what I could add. Absolutely, we should, you know, it's not thinking of our own experiences as some kind of guiding principle. On the other hand, I do think there is a danger of trying to think how they think sometimes. And New Testament scholarship, I think, one of the worst examples, people like Bruce Molina and the Context Group, who generalise about the Mediterranean, the Arab world, in a way to get away from subjectivity, and I think it's had disastrous results. So you've got to be careful on that side of it as well. But I totally agree with Richard's points on that.
I mean, coming back just briefly then, as we come to the end, your main concern in this area has been what does Richard's thesis do when it comes to if we're claiming that this is eyewitness testimony of the miraculous? I mean, does this... when Richard makes the claim that people were being eyewitness to miraculous events, do you immediately have to bat that out of hand? Is that kind of... I mean, I just want to be clear as to what... whether that invalidates in some sense the testimony, if you just say that, well, we have to take eyewitness testimony with a pinch of salt. I'm not sure where you finally kind of find yourself when it comes to... You seem to be quite persuaded by the idea that the Gospels are based on eyewitness testimony. I'm just not sure where you actually stand on the reliability of that eyewitness testimony. Just duped into thinking something that...
Well, I guess that's theoretically possible, but that's not really what I'm getting at there. What I like about Richard's model, it works for a lot of the Gospel material.
But only stuff that's not miraculous?
Well, I mean, I haven't really gone into the historicity of the miraculous, and I'll probably avoid it for the rest of my life. but what I'm trying to do is actually provoke Richard into the discussion rather than myself. So how's his model going to explain this? See, I don't feel obliged to explain it in one sense because I don't feel the need. And also maybe to even push him a bit on bringing a bit more of a chaotic model in there, you know, to say that there are other things going on as well. But I mean, let's, what we shouldn't forget in a debate like this is, you know, I mean, I don't buy anyone's work 100%, and you never do. But you look for the big points and you look for the big persuasive issues. And that's the important thing, I think. The other stuff is me trying to...
I mean, is your ultimate point that we just can't know what was going on when Peter or whoever reports a miracle?
If he did,
we can't know what the circumstances were of that, and it's the kind of issue where, I mean, it stands as distinctively different to him reporting the crucifixion or something like that because of the nature of what he's reporting. I mean,
yeah, there is that. I think you've got to take that on board in one sense, because I mean, these are the miraculous are by definition dramatic events, and this is doing something staggering in one sense if we push the model that hard.
And so we've got to treat the testimony of those events as differently to testimony of what we can.
Well, if they are testimony, I'm not sure if we can call it, we should be calling it testimony necessarily. This is why I bring in other ideas about rewriting, storytelling, that kind of thing, you know, more creative storytelling. So I wouldn't necessarily call that testimony. I would just, you know, call it creative writing or something like this. I don't know. That kind of thing, I think we also need to bring in to the model of the gospel tradition.
But for you, the creative aspect of the eyewitness testimony is not prominent as James appears to be saying, Richard.
No, I don't think so. And it'd be quite hard to read 1 Corinthians 15 as a creative account. I think Paul is just boldly listing the people who were known to have experienced this. I do think, I mean, to take a slightly broader view, you know, if what I were doing was to, as it were, validate a Christian understanding of Christian origins, I would not want to isolate the resurrection from a whole complex of things. And, you know, in the end, I believe in the resurrection, both because there is pretty good evidence of it, but also because I can make sense of it in terms of my general understanding of God and the world and who Jesus Christ was and so forth. And it makes sense as what God would do coming from that perspective. I mean, I don't think one could believe in the resurrection as the early Christians did without expecting the resurrection of everyone else at the consummation of history, because the two were entailed by early Christian theology. So that, you know, accepting the resurrection entails other religious convictions. And I would prefer to kind of explore the complex of beliefs and claims, among which was something that I think a great many historians, like James, would admit something extraordinary happened. I suppose defining what it was that happened becomes more important if one is led to that by one being generally impressed by the story of Jesus and so forth in the way that Christian believers are.
Well, we're just about out of time, so we'll take a quick break and then just 5 minutes to really sum up what has been two shows of, you know, really looking at some depth at Jesus and the eyewitnesses. So we'll be back in just a couple of moments' time.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So it's my great thanks to both of my guests who have joined me for the last 2 weeks, Richard Borkham and James Crossley. Fascinating in-depth analysis. If you want to really see the full thing, you've got to read the book Jesus and the Eyewitnesses by Richard Borkham. Link to it, of course, at the Unbelievable webpage. And both gentlemen will be joining me again in a few weeks' time to look at a different book by Richard, Jesus and the God of Israel. So keep listening for more details of that. But finally, gentlemen, I think there's been an awful lot you've agreed on. There have been aspects, obviously, you've disagreed on in the last 2 weeks as we've looked at these issues. it's possibly not surprising that your book has been warmly welcomed by the evangelical, if you like, wing of the church, Richard, because essentially it does consolidate, it does, as you said before, with different arguments, consolidate a conservative view of Scripture. When you said you've had a lot of response to the book, when people have responded negatively, has it been because they think your arguments are bad? Or is there some element to which people don't like the idea that you're towing a conservative line, that they don't like a return to some kind of...
There is that. And I think, in a way, there's a difference of situation in America from Britain, which I've often noticed. I mean, the difference between conservative approaches and more liberal approaches is very polemical in America. And I think it's partly because New Testament scholarship goes on over such a wide range of institutions, and very often the institutions in which it happens are kind of identified or identify themselves as conservative, liberal, and so forth. I do think the world of New Testament scholarship in Britain is very different in a way that I certainly prefer, which is that we all know each other and meet and talk about these things, you know, and go to the same conferences and, you know, and have a respect for each other. And therefore, I think, listen more carefully to each other's points of view than you do in this highly polemical situation where you're disinclined to take something seriously simply because of the camp that it comes from or the views you're associating with it and so forth. I think we do have an advantage in Britain in this respect in having a much more sort of collegial body of biblical scholars who take each other seriously.
Do you think this is changing then? I mean, is this... this book, has it sort of changed the direction of scholarship? I mean, is that too grand? It sounds like you're blowing your own trumpet if you say yes, but in the sense, you know, there are some significant quotes on the back, you know, N.T. Wright, James Dunn, others who, you know, Choice saying it will be hard to take seriously future works of the origins of the Gospels that have not interacted with Borkum. I mean, do you think that this is, if you like, the direction of scholarship now? Do you think form criticism is a thing of the past, or is this just another kind of book in the kind of the toing and froing?
Yes. I hope it is. I think the phenomenon, which is not unexpected, is that younger scholars are much more ready to take this on board than scholars who have worked their whole career with a different paradigm. Mm. And frankly, I wouldn't expect someone to easily change a paradigm that they've worked with all their careers, you know? And I do think that a new paradigm needs to be subjected to serious criticism. You know, it needs to be tested. It shouldn't be too easily lapped up, you know. I also think it's a book with a whole lot of ideas in it. And it wouldn't at all surprise me if some of those ideas fared better than others in the long run. But I would hope that in terms of a general direction, it may, as it were, reorientate the way people approach gospel scholarship.
James, thank you very much for being on the programme as well. For you, in terms of the way that you see scholarship going, do you think Richard's onto a winner here as far as this is the new paradigm? Yeah. We've been talking about a paradigm shift, and do you think this is the new paradigm when it comes to looking at the early Christianity and the Gospels?
Well, I mean, first of all, I really don't like to predict futures, because especially if it's recorded. It's interesting. I think Richard's right in terms of the age issue. Time will tell, in one sense, when we get a generation of people coming through and becoming the main scholars in biblical studies. That will be when the testing point for this, I think, in many ways. My concern is, and this is my concern for scholarship in general at the moment, is that I think it's heavily polarised in a way it's not been. I mentioned it earlier. Between a kind, especially the American context. I mean, if you think of the cultural context in America, where Dawkins and Co. are very much more prominent there than they are here. Yeah. And as is the kind of hard evangelical reaction, it is very different. And that's reflected in a lot of scholarship, I think. What we're going to see soon is this Jesus Project as well, which where there are people on board who think Jesus didn't exist. I mean, this is coming, I think, in one sense, even if, you know, the majority of people somewhere in between would never associate. So I think, as far as a paradigm goes, I don't know if scholarship is going that way anymore. The days of Bultmann dominating, I think, are gone. Things are much more diverse, for good or bad. If you look at historical Jesus scholarship, it's just there's just no consensus in so many areas. You know, people are so persuaded, and you can pretty much pigeonhole people by their religious beliefs quite easily in historical Jesus scholarship. So I think there certainly will be people taking this on board, including myself and others. But I think the way that kind of some hard views are embedded in scholarship at the moment will not necessarily mean it's going to be taken on by everybody, as we've seen in some of the broad range of responses, I think, to the book. Maybe that's not necessarily a bad thing if we don't all agree. But, I think it'll depend on cultural context in many, many ways.
Well, if you're listening in North America and you want to
we love you.
Get in touch, you're welcome to drop me a line at the usual place, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Many listeners buy podcast in America. Perhaps you've read the book, perhaps you'd like to respond to it, wherever you stand on this, because I know we have people of every persuasion listening to this programme. Be interested to hear from you. My thanks once again to my guests who joined me this week and last to look at this fascinating book, Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. Do go to premier.org.uk/unbelievable to listen back to this programme and last week's, when we looked at the book, and to find links to my guests and to the book. Thank you, gentlemen, both, for being with me today.
Thank you for listening to today's classic replay on the Gospels, which was first broadcast on Premier Christian Radio on the 5th of September 2009. You can get in touch and listen to more classic shows from our podcast archive at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.